In this portrait, Kelsey noticed a new development. The woman wore one sapphire. The child wore the other. Kelsey bent down to the attached plaque and read, Amanda Raleigh.
Ah, the beautiful queen.
Father Tyler moved down to join her in front of the portrait. Kelsey's guards, most of whom had been scattered down at the far end of the room, slightly bored, moved closer as well, staring avidly up at the portrait. Kelsey felt irritation bite against her mind. But then she spotted a second child in the portrait, tucked almost behind the beautiful queen's skirts. This girl was even younger than the child on the queen's lap, perhaps no more than 3 or 4. But already she was dark-haired and sullen-looking, and Kelsey was suddenly reminded of her own childhood self, staring back at her in the pool of still water behind the cottage. In the radiance of the beautiful queen and her daughter, the girl was easy to miss. And Kelsey realized that this must have been the artist's deliberate choice, to highlight one child and obscure the other. The beautiful queen had only one child, so I'm told. That must be Queen Elaine on her lap. Kelsey pointed to the little girl who cringed behind the beautiful queen's skirts. So, who's this? Mace shrugged.
No idea.
Father Tyler considered the girl.
But his favourite child would be my guess.
Amanda Raleigh had a husband, Thomas Arness.
He was Elaine's father. But I've heard that Amanda was hardly faithful to Arness, and there may have been other children. Disfavored children sometimes show up in royal portraits from the pre-crossing, but never in positions of prominence. A cruel thing, really. Almost worse than not being included at all.
Father Tyler studied the portrait for a moment before remarking,
This is the worst case I've ever seen. That child is completely marginalized.
Kelsey stared at the little girl, pity stirring inside her. Unlike the smiling princess on the beautiful queen's lap, the hidden girl had dark, unhappy eyes. She wasn't looking at the artist as the other two subjects did. Rather, she was staring up at the beautiful queen, her gaze filled with poorly concealed longing. Kelsey suddenly wanted to weep and didn't know whether it was for the child or for herself. In the next portrait, the child on the beautiful queen's lap had grown up and borne a child of her own. The engraving identified them as Queen Elaine and Crown Princess Arla. Elaine was not as beautiful as her mother. But who could be? Kelsey wondered bitterly. But she reminded Kelsey of someone. Andalai? No, for although this woman was a brunette, she didn't have Andalai's pale, ethereal style of beauty. Queen Elaine did not smile for the artist. She, too, looked extremely annoyed at having to sit for a portrait.
See here, lady, Dyer pointed at Elaine's face. She has your stubborn jaw. Hilarious, Kelsey muttered. But she couldn't deny that there was a likeness, even now, when so many changes had overtaken her own face. Before Dyer could remark on anything else, she continued to the next portrait.
Arla the Just sat on the tier throne, no child in sight, both sapphires around her neck and the tier crown on her head. Fascinated, Kelsey stared at the crown, a single elegant circle of silver, set with perhaps 4 or 5 sapphires. She tapped her finger against the canvas. Any luck on finding that thing, Lazarus?
None yet, lady.
Kelsey nodded, disappointed but not surprised, and turned back to the portrait. Queen Arla had not been particularly pretty, but she possessed a magnetic quality that shone clearly through the canvas. She was much older than the other Raleigh women, and Kelsey remembered then that Queen Elaine had lived long, that her daughter had not been crowned until she was nearing her own middle age. Arla had been an autocrat, and the portrait showed her as such, reflected a clear determination to have her own way. Her smile was so contented that it was nearly smug, radiating pride to the point of arrogance. But pride had gotten Arla in trouble in the long run. Barbarians at the walls, Kelsey's mind whispered. And she provoked them, just like you.
She shook the thought off, moved quickly to the next portrait, and found herself staring up at her mother.
Queen Alyssa did not look at all the way Kelsey had imagined. There had been long days in the cottage, lonely days when Carlin had been angry with her, when Kelsey would console herself by picturing the phantom woman who had borne her. A delicate, willowy woman, like something out of a Grimm tale. But the Alyssa in the portrait did not look frail at all. She was tall, taller than Kelsey, and she radiated health and substance. A striking blonde woman with sparkling green eyes. She stood beside a plain, unadorned table, but she was grinning, the carefree grin of a woman with nothing in the world to worry about. Kelsey, who had almost been pleased with this version of her mother, found herself latching on to that grin. Even if the portrait had been painted immediately after Alyssa took the throne, the Mort would already be tearing their way through the Tyr countryside. The Mort Treaty, the lottery, these things couldn't be far away. And the utter carelessness of her mother's expression sharpened Kelsey's resolve, her determination that no one would suffer for her mistakes.
Lady, Mace murmured.
What?
It does no good to dwell on the past. The future now, that's everything.
Kelsey was annoyed that Mace had read her so easily. But she saw no judgment in his face, only his own brand of hard truth. And after a moment she relaxed, shrugging. And yet sometimes the answer to the future lies in the past, Lazarus.
Mace turned and barked. Spread out, all of you.
Kelsey's guards moved away to all ends of the room. Kelsey stared at Mace, bewildered, but he only moved closer and murmured,
Is that where you go at night, lady? On your wanderings? The past?
Kelsey swallowed, though something seemed to catch in her throat. What makes you think I go anywhere?
Penn missed it. That night last week. He was on the library door. But I was right next to you, lady. You said, there's a better world out there. So close we can almost touch it.
I know those words.
There was a song about them in the village where I grew up.
A song of the crossing. I was sleepwalking. Mace chuckled.
You're no more a sleepwalker than Andalai's little one, lady. I found her in Arliss's office the other night. When Arliss is gone, that office is always locked. But Glee got in there, all the same.
What's your point, Lazarus?
That night, for a minute, just before you came out of your fugue, you seemed to fade.
Fade? The word chilled Kelsey, but she produced a half-hearted snicker.
Laugh if you like, lady. I did see it.
Mace leaned in even closer now, lowering his voice to a whisper.
Do you ever consider, lady, that it might be better to simply take them off and throw them away?
Kelsey reached up automatically, taking her jewels in a clenched fist. She didn't know whether they even functioned any longer, or whether something else was working on her now. But everything in her rebelled at the idea of taking them off. Mace shook his head and then gave her a pained grin.
Well, it was worth a try. Look here, lady,
Corin announced, pointing to the next portrait.
Oh, for God's sake,
Kelsey breathed. Her uncle's face beamed down at her from the wall, younger than the man she had met, but unmistakably Thomas Raleigh. He carried less weight, and his nose didn't quite have the alcoholic shade of red that it would attain later. But the air of entitlement, the sense of being God's gift to the earth, these things emanated from the canvas in nearly visible waves.
Take that nonsense down, Kelsey snapped. He's not a Tyr monarch. He never was. Get rid of it.
I'll take care of it, lady, Mace replied. I had no idea he'd put up a portrait. I haven't been down here in years.
Doesn't anyone use this gallery?
I doubt it. Look at the dust.
Kelsey went back to glaring at her mother's portrait. Even if she somehow found a solution to the Mort nightmare on the horizon, it did nothing for the 50,000 tier who had already gone to Mortmain. Her mother's gift to the world. This was familiar territory. A problem with no solution.
"May I ask you a question, lady?"
Dyer asked.
"Please." "I wondered if you had decided what to do with the prisoner Javel."
"I will let him out of prison, certainly, but only once I've thought of a way to keep him from drinking himself to death."
Kelsey turned away from the portraits to face her five guards, who stood in front of the sunlit windows like a row of chessmen.
"I don't know what to do with the boy, the jailer, either. He's earned some reward, but for the life of me I don't know what to give him.
Does he have no friends?
No one who knows him well?"
Corin spoke up.
"I know his father a little. The old jailer retired now. I can ask."
"Do that. I don't want the reward to be meaningless. They gave us a great gift, both you and Javel."
"And what will you do with the gift?" Penn asked.
It was the first full sentence Kelsey had gotten in days, but she wished that she could just ignore him.
"What about Thorn?"
"I don't know."
"Better decide soon, lady,"
Dyer cut in.
"The entire kingdom is screaming for his blood."
"Yes, but they scream for the wrong reasons. They want him to suffer because of his years as overseer of the census. Yet that was a government position, and as terrible as they were, Thorn's actions as overseer were legal under the regency. I can't have a rule of law that bows under public pressure. If I execute Thorn, it must be for his crimes."
"He's guilty of treason, lady."
"And yet that's not the reason the entire kingdom will line up to watch him hang."
The five guards stared at her, and Kelsey felt more than ever that she was on a chessboard, a pawn facing five power pieces.
"You all agree that I should execute him?"
They all nodded, even Penn, who Kelsey had thought might be a secret holdout.
"I'll make a decision soon, but not yet.
I did promise Elston his fun, you know."
Leaving them chuckling behind her, Kelsey moved back down the gallery to have another look at the man from the fireplace. He was even more striking in daylight, and although the portrait was clearly very old, he had not aged a day since. His eyes followed her as she came closer, and although Kelsey knew it was silly, she felt as though he really could see her from a distance.
"Take this one down as well," she said finally. "I don't know who he is, but he is not a monarch. He doesn't belong on this wall."
"Shall we get rid of it?"
"No. Bring it upstairs."
She peered around her guards until she found Father Tyler staring out the window.
"Thank you, Father.
Most interesting, this place."
"Yes, lady," the priest replied absently, but his bleak gaze remained fixed on the mountains.
"What have they done to him?"
Kelsey wondered again. Her eyes strayed to the cast on his knee. She was surprised by her own protective instinct toward the priest. It was an old man, one who wanted only to sit and read books and think about the past. It seemed a crime for anyone to harm him. On several mornings lately, Kelsey had found Father Tyler asleep on his favorite sofa in the library, as though he no longer wished to spend his nights in the Arvath. Had the Holy Father done something else to him? If he had...
"Stop," Kelsey told herself.
She couldn't try to assert authority over the inner workings of the Arvath. That path would only lead to disaster. She pushed God's Church from her mind, and as it went, she suddenly had an idea, a possible solution. Not to Father Tyler, but to another problem.
"Lazarus, can any of the guards speak Mort?"
Mace blinked in surprise.
"Kib, Dyer, and Galen, lady, and myself."
"Do any of them speak it well enough to pass for Mort?"
"Only Galen, really."
Mace's brow furrowed.
"What's on your mind?"
"We're going back upstairs now, but not everyone. Two of you go down to the dungeon and bring me Javel. Try to wake him up a bit.
But an hour later, when Javel entered the Queen's wing, Kelsey was disappointed to see that his earlier apathy had not changed. He looked around without interest as Corin escorted him to the foot of the dais, then simply stood staring at the ground. Where was the man who had attacked the burning cage all alone with an axe? Kelsey wondered whether she would have seen the real Javel on the day Thorn had broken into the dungeon. Ewan had been very cagey about what had happened down there, but Mace finally got the whole truth from him. If Ewan hadn't intervened, Javel would have beaten Thorn to death with his bare hands. That was the man Kelsey wanted to see. She was pleased to notice that Ewan had at least left off Javel's manacles. There was no need for restraint. Javel merely stood there, straight and beaten, as though waiting for his own execution. "Javel?" He didn't look up, only replied hollowly, "Majesty, you've done me a great service in the capture of Arlan Thorn."
"Yes, Majesty, thank you."
"I have pardoned you. You're free to leave the keep now at any time and go your own way. But I would ask you to stay and listen to a proposal."
"What proposal?"
"I'm told that your wife went to Mortmain in the shipment 6 years ago. Is this correct?"
"Yes."
"Is she still alive?"
"I don't know," Javel replied listlessly. "Thorn said so.
He said he could get her back. But now I think it was all lies and she's dead."
"Why?"
"She was a pretty woman, my Allie. They don't last long."
Kelsey winced but plowed forward. "Was your Allie pretty and weak, Javel? Or was she pretty and tough?"
"A damn sight tougher than me, lady, though that doesn't say much."
"And yet you think she couldn't have survived 6 years in a Mortnock house?" Javel looked up, and Kelsey was pleased to see a hint of anger in his eyes.
"Why say this to me, lady? Do you wish to make it worse?"
"I wish to see whether you still care about anything at all. Do you think your wife would be happy to see you here now, like this?"
"That's between her and me."
Javel looked around him, seeming to notice Corin for the first time.
"You said I was free to leave."
"So you are. The door is behind you." Javel turned and walked away. Kelsey sensed Mace bridling beside her, but to his credit, he kept quiet. "What will you do now, Javel?" she called after him.
"Find the nearest pub."
"Is that what your wife would have wanted?"
"She's dead."
"You don't know that." Javel kept walking. "Don't you want to find out?" He halted, perhaps 10 feet from the doors. "I have ended the lottery, Javel," Kelsey continued, staring at his back, willing him to stay still. "No shipment will ever leave this country under my crown. But that doesn't redress the wrongs of the past, the Tyr already in Mortmain. What do I do about all of them, all of those slaves?" "The answer is clear. I have to get them out." Javel remained in place, but Kelsey saw his shoulders heave once, an involuntary movement. "Lazarus is thinking that I have other things to worry about," she continued with a nod to Mace. "And he's right. My people are starving and uneducated. We have no true medicine. On the eastern border is an army that will crush us into dust. These are real problems, and so for a time I've let the others lie. But here is where Lazarus and I differ a bit. He believes that avoiding the wrongs of the future is more important than righting the wrongs of the past."
"So it is, lady," Mace muttered,
and Kelsey threw him a quick, pained grin. She wished that Father Tyler was still here. He would have understood. But he had already gone back to the Arvath. "Lazarus means well, but he's mistaken. The wrongs of the past are not less significant, they're just harder to fix. And the longer you ignore them, in favor of more pressing issues, the worse the harm, until the problems of the past actually create the problems of the future. And that brings us back to your Allie."
Javel turned around, and Kelsey saw that his eyes were wet.
"Let's say, for argument's sake, that your wife is alive, Javel. Let's say that the very worst has happened to her in Mortmain. The most terrible thing that your imagination can conjure. Would you still want her back?"
"Of course I would," Javel spat. "Do you think it was easy, watching her carted off in the cage? I would do anything to change it."
"You can't change it. And since you can't, I ask you again, do you still want her back?"
"I do."
"Then, here is my proposal. You will go to Mortmain with two of my guard. I will arm and fund you. And if you can get your alley out, then I'll know it can be done."
Javel blinked, his expression doubtful.
"I'm not a particularly good fighter, lady. I can't even speak, Mort."
"And you're a drunk," Dyer remarked from the wall.
"Shut up, Dyer," Kelsey snapped, thinking of Barty. Barty, she now suspected, had been an alcoholic. There was no way to know for sure, but a thousand tiny hints had been scattered throughout her childhood. "Your drunkenness, Javel, is not my primary concern. I want someone committed to the enterprise."
"I only want my alley back."
"That's all I'm asking you for."
"I'll go."
Javel's eyes gleamed.
Not with life. Not yet. But at least with some purpose.
"I don't know how it can work, but I'll go."
"Good. Take a few days for yourself. Get your affairs in order. Lazarus will be in touch."
Javel's face fell. He had clearly meant to leave right then.
Mace stepped forward and growled,
"Do yourself a favor, gate guard, and stay out of the pubs. This will be a tough trick, even with a clear head."
"I can do that."
"Good. Devin, escort him to the gate."
Javel followed the guard out the door with wandering footsteps, as though unsure of where he was going.
"You're mad, lady," Mace muttered. "The ways that this can fail, I can't even list them. And you want to send two of my best men along with that ass."
"When it fails, they do call it madness, Lazarus. But when it succeeds, they call it genius. And the genius will be yours, for I'm putting this entire operation into your hands. I want to know nothing more about it."
"Thank God for small favors."
Kelsey smiled, but as the doors closed, she whipped around sharply.
"Dyer."
He came forward. "Your mouth is a fine source of amusement to me, Dyer. But that means nothing if you can't learn when to keep it shut."
"I apologize, Majesty."
"You speak passable, Mort, yes?"
Dyer blinked.
"I do, lady. My accent isn't wonderful, but I am fluent."
"Why?" Kelsey glanced at Mace, who gave her an almost imperceptible nod.
Dyer stared at them for a moment, then groaned.
"Oh, lady, don't tell me."
"You're going, my friend," Mace cut in. "You and Galen."
Dyer looked up at Kelsey, and she was surprised to see real hurt in his eyes.
"Am I being punished, lady?"
"Of course not. This is important work."
"To break a single slave out of Mortmain?"
"Think bigger, you prick,"
Mace growled.
"I'm sending you over there. Do you really think you have only one agenda?"
This time it was Kelsey who blinked, but she recovered quickly. If she was already looking further down the road, it was no surprise that Mace was doing the same. The Mort Rebellion. It had to be. Mace had made it something of a pet project in his limited free time. Under his direction, the Crown had already sent several shipments of goods to the rebels in Cité Marche.
"I apologize, Majesty," Dyer said.
"Accepted."
Kelsey glanced at her watch.
"Is it dinner yet?" "Miller says 30 minutes, Majesty,"
a new man called from the kitchen doorway.
"Call me when it's ready,"
Kelsey told Mace, climbing off the throne.
"All of you have worn me out today."
In her chamber, she found the portrait they had brought up from the gallery now leaning against the wall beside her fireplace. Kelsey stared at it for a long moment, then turned to Penn.
Go away.
Lady.
What?
Penn splayed his hands.
Things can't remain like this forever. We have to move past what happened.
I have moved past it.
You haven't,
Penn spoke quietly, but Kelsey heard the low hum of anger in his voice.
It was a weak moment, and it won't repeat.
I'm a Queen's Guard, lady. You have to understand that.
I understand that you're just like every other man in the world. Get out.
Penn's breath hissed through his teeth, and Kelsey was pleased to see real pain in his eyes for a moment before he retreated to his antechamber. But as soon as he pulled the curtain closed, she collapsed in her armchair, regretting her own words. Here had been a perfectly good opportunity to repair the situation, and she had thrown it away.
Why must I be such a child?
Looking up, Kelsey caught a glimpse of her own reflection in the mirror and stiffened. She wasn't a child anymore. The ground had shifted beneath her again. A pretty, though stern, woman stared back at her from the glass. Even by the soft light of the fire, Kelsey could see that her cheekbones had become more prominent. They seemed to shape her face, pointing it downward toward a mouth that had somehow become lush. Kelsey gave a croak of laughter. If she had a fairy godmother somewhere, then the old woman must be senile, for she was granting the wrong wishes, those that mattered least. The tear was in a shambles, and the Mort army had begun its assault on the border, but Kelsey grew prettier by the day. Maybe this is what I wished for, she thought, staring at the mirror. Maybe this is what I wanted more than any other thing. A phrase from one of Carlin's books recurred. Blood will tell. Kelsey thought of the portrait two floors beneath her, the smiling blonde woman with no care in the world beyond her own pleasure, and felt like screaming. But the face in the mirror remained serene, mysterious, just on the point of deepening into beauty. True queen, Kelsey muttered bitterly, and heard her voice crack. Her reflection blurred for a moment, became indistinct. She blinked, confused, and then found herself fading, that curious sense of incipient otherness, of becoming someone else, which she had experienced before. She should call Penn, warn him that she was starting on one of her fugues, but humiliation overwhelmed her, and for a moment she could not find her voice. The power of this particular memory did not seem to fade with the passage of time. At any moment it could rise like the tide, swamping Kelsey and drowning her in an ocean of shame. Why should she tell Penn what was coming? It would serve him right if she blundered into a wall or a piece of furniture, if she injured herself on his watch.
You are being utterly childish.
These aren't real problems. Lily has real problems. The Tearling has real problems. Your little dramas aren't even on the map. Kelsey tried to shut the voice out, but it was too right to ignore, and for a moment she loathed the sensible side of herself, that pragmatic core that no longer allowed her even the luxury of throwing a tantrum. The room faded around her, rippling, and Kelsey felt a moment of wonder at how close the two worlds seemed to be, Lily's life and her own. Sometimes it seemed as though they lay right beside each other, perfectly aligned, as though Kelsey could step over some line and simply be in a different time, in the America that was gone. Penn? He appeared in moments, his face stiff.
I'm going, Kelsey murmured.
The room was fading away now, and as Penn approached, she found that he was fading as well, until she could look right through him into a sunlit room.
It's all right, lady, Penn murmured. I won't let you fall.
His grip on her arm was good, strong and comforting, but Kelsey sensed that in time, even that would fade. Chapter 8 Roe Finn.
The Frewell administration liked to propound the age-old fiction that women were frail and indecisive creatures, badly in need of homes and husbands to give them structure and guidance. But even the most cursory glance at the late pre-crossing suggests otherwise. American women were extremely resourceful in this period. They had to be, in order to survive in a world that valued them for only one thing. Indeed, many women were forced to create secret lives, lives about which we know very little, and about which their husbands certainly knew nothing. The Dark Knight of America, Lee Delamere. After 2 days, Lily had run out of books. Dorian was a voracious reader, and she went through Lily's hidden stash like lightning. Lily offered her a pocket reader, but Dorian dismissed it with a contemptuous sniff. "All the e-books are edited and purged. I worked a stretch in a smart book factory, and the government people were all over the place editing content. Stick with hard copies. They're harder to alter after publication. In the better world, there won't be any electronics at all." The better world. Lily had thought it was only a slogan, something that the Blue Horizon used to make its deeds seem more innocuous. But now she wondered. The tall Englishman, Tyr, had seemed so certain that it was real. "There is no better world."
"There will be," Dorian replied calmly. "It's close now. So close that we can almost touch it."
That was the same thing Tyr had said. The words had the ring of religious rhetoric. But Dorian seemed too practical for that.
For that matter, so did Tyr.
In the past couple of days, Lily had done several online searches, but the information was very sparse. There was a birth record for a William Tyr from Southport, England, in 2046, and 11 years ago, a William Tyr had been awarded the Military Cross for heroism with the Special Air Service. Lily had assumed that the Special Air Service was the British version of the old American Air Force, but after some more research, she found that the American analogue to the SAS was actually the SEALs. Now she was certain she had the right man. She had met plenty of paramilitary types through Greg, and the men always projected an air of invincibility. Tyr had given the same impression, but it was combined with something else. Something close to omniscience. For a few insane moments there in the nursery, Lily had been sure that he knew everything about her. There was no other information on Tyr, which seemed impossible. Lily could look up her friend's drug prescriptions, the legal ones anyway, their genealogies, their medical records, tax statements, even their DNA sequences, if she felt like it. But William Tyr had been born, had served in the British Special Forces, and that was all. The rest of his life had disappeared. When Lily searched for Dorian Rice, she found the same thing. The results yielded countless news stories, but they had all been published in the last few days and dealt with the explosion at the airbase. Greg had said that Dorian had escaped from the Bronx Women's Detention Center, but there was no arrest record online. There was no mention of Dorian's family, no birth certificate. It was as though someone had literally wiped Dorian and Tyr from history. But only security had the power to remove things from the net. The days when citizens could edit their own information had vanished with the enactment of the Emergency Powers Act. Lily longed to ask Dorian about herself, but she didn't want Dorian to know that she'd gone snooping. Dorian had stopped jumping at every little thing, but she still displayed an odd paranoia that came and went. She didn't want to discuss William Tyr. Whenever Lily mentioned him, Dorian would snap, "No names," making Lily feel as though she had blasphemed somehow. Dorian was able to sit up now to make her way across the nursery, but she still froze whenever the phone rang, and she didn't like to be touched. She insisted on doing her own injections. Tyr wasn't the only topic that was off-limits. When it came to the better world, Dorian remained maddeningly evasive, speaking in vague phrases and giving no real answers. Lily couldn't tell whether she was holding something back. Maybe Tyr's followers didn't understand the better world either. Maybe they were just as much in the dark. And yet
Lily was desperate to know. The vision she had seen that night with Tyr had taken hold in her mind, a vast open land covered with wheat and the blue ribbon of river. No guards or walls or checkpoints, only small wooden houses, people moving along freely, children running through wheat.
"When does it arrive, this better world?" Lily asked.
"I don't know," Dorian replied. "But I don't think it's very far off now."
On Sunday, Lily had to leave Dorian alone to go to church, and she fretted through the service. She barely heard the priest's lecture on the sins of a childless woman, although, as always, the priest looked right at Lily and the other delinquents in his congregation. Greg put a hand on Lily's back, trying to convey sympathy, she supposed, but the deep gleam in his eyes made her uneasy. Greg was planning something, certainly, and it could be nothing good. For a brief moment, she wondered if he was scheming to divorce her. Even after the Frewell laws, the government would still ease the way for rich executives who wanted to shed barren wives. But Lily was beginning to see something now that she'd never seen before. To Greg, she was property, and Greg wasn't a man to give property away, not even if it was damaged. Lily wondered if things would change someday when she became irreparably childless.
"Cheerful thoughts, Candy Ass," Maddie whispered, and Lily blinked.
Ever since Dorian had rolled over the back wall into the garden, it seemed as though Maddie was everywhere, always ready to offer her opinion. But it was rarely anything that Lily wanted to hear. After church, Greg directed his driver, Phil, to take them to the club. Lunch at the club was a Sunday routine, but Lily wished she could beg off. The thought of their friends was almost unbearable today. Lily wanted to be back in the nursery with Dorian, trying to unravel the mystery of the better world. As they pulled out of the church parking lot, Greg pushed the button that raised the partition, blocking Phil out. Lily was alarmed to see his eyes bright with excitement.
"I found a doctor."
"A doctor?" Lily repeated cautiously.
"He's not cheap, but he's licensed, and he's willing to do it."
"Do what?"
"Plant you."
For a moment, Lily had no idea what he was talking about. The word plant made her think of implants, and her mind went automatically to the tag in her shoulder. But no, Greg meant something else. A truly awful idea popped into Lily's mind, and she shrank from it. But she also knew that it was exactly what Greg meant.
"In vitro?"
"Of course."
Greg took her hand, leaning forward.
"Listen to this. The doctor says he can use my sperm. Just stick it in another woman's eggs. You have the baby and no one ever has to know."
Lily's mind went blank. For a moment, she considered simply throwing open the car door, rolling out while it was still in motion, and fleeing to... where?
"What if it's not my eggs that are the problem?"
Greg's brow furrowed, and his lower lip pushed out a fraction of an inch. He had expected his idea to be received with enthusiasm, Lily saw now, and the unadulterated contempt that had reared its head on the night of Dorian's arrival, of the rape, Maddie reminded her, seemed to multiply and fester inside her. Greg thought that he'd come up with a great idea, that having another woman's eggs forcibly implanted inside her would seem like a godsend to Lily. And for the first time, it occurred to her to wonder whether Greg even understood that he had raped her. After Frewell, it was almost impossible to prove rape at all, and spousal rape hadn't been prosecuted in years. What would consent even mean to Greg? The bulk of his sexual education seemed to have come from his father and his frat buddies, and none of them had done him any favours. Lily cleared her throat, dragging the words up as though with a chainfall. It would be so much easier not to say anything, but she had to know.
"The other night..."
"I'm sorry, Lil."
Greg took her hand, cutting her off.
"I didn't mean to take it all out on you. Even without the bombing, work has been so bad lately."
"You raped me."
Greg's mouth popped open, an expression of such complete surprise overtaking his face that Lily realized she had been right. He didn't know. She turned away, staring out the window. They were just passing through the great stone arch of the New Canaan Country Club, and beyond, the vast greens of the golf course stretched toward the near horizon. Greg cleared his throat, and Lily knew what was coming even before he spoke.
"You're my wife."
Before she knew what she was doing, she laughed. Greg's face darkened, but he didn't know that Lily wasn't laughing at him, but at herself. Frewell's bullshit had worked on her too, because until the other night she had honestly believed that marriage turned men into better people, better protectors. But marriage didn't change anyone.
Lily had married a man shaped by his father, the same father who had put a hand on Lily's ass at the wedding rehearsal dinner,
and asked whether he could get an early slice of the cake. Was she actually surprised now that this was where they had ended up? Was she even allowed to complain?
"The tag, Lil,"
Maddie whispered. And she was right. The tag was the great equalizer. Lily couldn't run, because no matter where she ran to, all the money in the world wouldn't keep Greg from finding her there, and security wouldn't lift a finger to stop him from taking her back. They would fall all over themselves to assist one of their own. The car pulled up at the entryway, and Lily sensed Greg's relief at the end of the conversation. Coldness had descended on Lily now, a state of nearly frozen calculation. For the first time, she saw that she might have even bigger problems than what had happened the other night. She knew the amount of professional grief Greg was enduring about being childless. It was certainly impeding his career. But she had underestimated how desperate Greg was, how far he was willing to go. They moved through the enormous marble entryway of the club, an edifice that Lily usually admired, but now she barely saw it, her mind continuing forward on its unpleasant track. In vitro fertilization had been illegal since Lily was in grade school, but it was a booming black market among wealthy couples, who saw additional children as an easy way to earn the Frewell tax breaks. If Greg had found an in vitro doctor, would that doctor be able to tell that Lily was on contraception? Was there a way to flush the hormones out of her system somehow? She couldn't ask the internet. That was the sort of search that got you a visit from security.
"Why don't you tell him? You don't want kids."
But that was no longer possible, if it ever had been. She had told Greg so in tiny ways for years. It was nothing he was able to hear. And if the other night had proven anything, it was that what Lily wanted wasn't worth a damn. She would have to find a way around the in vitro doctor, just as she had always circumvented the surveillance system in her house. But at the moment, she could think of nothing. All of the years of her marriage, years she had spent scrambling, trying to escape this noose. And now it seemed to be drawing tight around her neck. Lily estimated that she had less than half an inch of space left. In the restaurant, the maitre d' led them toward their table, where Lily saw several of their friends, the Palmers and Keith Thompson, already seated. Lily didn't enjoy the circle jerk that was lunch with Greg's golf buddies and their wives. But their presence suddenly seemed like a godsend, infinitely better than sitting across from Greg alone. And Keith wasn't too bad, definitely her favorite of Greg's friends. He never leered or groped or shot veiled barbs about Lily's failure to get pregnant. He was a hurried little man who'd risen to become president of his family's grocery chain. His father was the chairman. At one of their dinner parties, Keith had wandered, extremely drunk, into the kitchen where Lily was organizing dessert, and they'd had a long talk, during which he confessed to Lily that he was simply waiting for his father to die. But he was only drinking water today, and his brittle smile telegraphed his displeasure at his lunch companions.
"Mayhew!"
Mark Palmer stood up, and Lily saw that he was already drunk. His cheeks were rosy, and he had to grab the edge of the table for balance.
Michelle, beside him, had her own buzz going. Her eyes were dull, and she merely nodded as Lily greeted her and took a chair. When Dow and Pfizer had merged, the resulting company had kept Mark and fired Michelle. But Michelle still had friends somewhere in the production line. She sold under-the-counter painkillers to half of New Canaan and made a good profit. Lily's body still ached whenever she sat down, and for a moment she considered doing a little business with Michelle today, but then discarded the idea. She was hiding a terrorist in her nursery, and Greg wanted to haul her off to a back-alley doctor. Painkillers would make Lily as dull as Michelle, who was her own best customer, and Lily couldn't afford that. But they would still need to go off to the bathroom at some point so that Lily could return Michelle's books and ask for more. Greg ordered whiskey, shooting another resentful look at Lily as the waiter walked away. She had driven him to drink, that look said. There was no introspection in Greg's gaze. The word rape seemed to have rolled off him like water. Lily suddenly remembered a day several years ago, a weekend in college, when they had driven up the coastline, not going anywhere in particular, simply cruising. Lily, with her right foot stuck out the passenger side window, and Greg, with his left hand on her thigh. What had happened to those two kids? Where had they gone? Lunch was served, but Sarah and Ford did not appear, which was odd. They always lunched at the club on Sundays. Lily hadn't seen them in church, either. "Where's Sarah?" she finally asked Michelle. The table went quiet, and Lily realized that everyone knew something she didn't. Michelle gave her a discouraging shake of the head, and Mark quickly began to tell a story about some mix-up at work. A few minutes later, Michelle jerked her chin toward the lobby, and Lily stood up.
"Where are you going?"
Greg had grabbed her wrist and was looking up at her with narrowed, suspicious eyes. Lily suddenly realized that she hated her husband, hated him more than she had ever hated anyone or anything in her entire life.
"To the bathroom? With Michelle?"
Greg let go, giving her arm a small jerk as he did so, and Lily stumbled away from the table. Keith Thompson stared after her with concerned eyes, and Lily wished she could tell him that it was all right, but that seemed extremely optimistic. In the bathroom, Lily asked again, "What happened to Sarah?" Michelle paused in the act of fixing her eyeliner.
"It happened 3 days ago. How do you not know?"
A fair question. There were no secrets in New Canaan. Lily usually knew the scandals of her neighbors before they even knew themselves.
"I've been busy."
"With what?"
"Nothing special." "What happened?"
"Sarah's in custody."
"What for?"
"She tried to take out her tag."
Lily said nothing for a moment, trying to connect this information with Sarah, who had once told Lily that her husband only used his fists because he cared so much. Of all Lily's friends, Sarah seemed the least likely to try something so drastic.
"What happened?"
"Don't know."
Michelle began to fix her lip liner.
"She went at her own shoulder with a knife. Missed the tag, but she nearly bled to death. Ford turned her in."
Now that was in character. Once on a family vacation, Ford had left Sarah at a rest stop on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. If Sarah hadn't called him a few minutes later, he might have been all the way to Harrisburg before he noticed she was gone.
"What'll happen to her?"
Michelle shrugged, and Lily saw that Michelle had already begun to forget about Sarah, to move on. This forgetting was something you learned to do when someone disappeared, the response so ingrained that it seemed like poor taste to do anything else. Lily had not been able to forget Maddie, but that was different. She bore fault.
"I have your books."
Lily pulled them from her bag, but before she could hand them over, Michelle reeled away, bent over, and threw up into the sink. Even before she was finished, the sink's cleaning mechanism began to wipe it away, making small, methodical, sweeping sounds. "Are you all right?" Lily asked, but Michelle waved her away. Her voice, when it came, was garbled.
"I'm pregnant again."
"Congratulations," Lily replied automatically. "Boy or girl?" Michelle spat into the sink.
"Boy. And a good thing, too. If we had another girl, Mark wanted to have it taken care of."
"What?"
"I don't really care either way."
Lily stared at her. Michelle had never talked this way before, and although Lily could imagine that it was no picnic being Mark Palmer's wife, she had always assumed that Michelle was like the rest of her friends, happy to be a mother. Michelle was always going to soccer games and bragging about her children's grades. Lily tentatively offered her the books again, and Michelle shoved them inside her enormous purse. The size of Michelle's handbags was a running joke among their group of friends, but she needed the space for all the contraband she had to transport around New Canaan. Michelle did many of her dealings in this very bathroom, one of the few places in the city that had no surveillance camera.
"What are you going to do?" Lily asked.
"Have it? What else am I going to do? Mark's already bragging to everyone at work."
"What about the painkillers?"
Michelle narrowed her eyes.
"What about them?"
Lily pursed her lips, feeling like the unpleasant chaperone at a party.
"Aren't they bad for the baby?"
"Who cares? 80% of upper-income mothers are on tranquilizers or painkillers or both. Didn't you know that?"
"No."
"Of course you didn't. Drug companies don't want that information made public.
People might start asking why."
Michelle fixed her with a disgusted stare.
"And then there's you. Never have to be pregnant, do you? Never have to be a mother."
Lily recoiled. She and Michelle had never been good friends, but they'd always gotten along. And now Lily realized how little that meant.
"Mark laughs at you two all the time, Greg and his empty oven. But you'll never have to have four screaming kids hanging off you, will you?"
Lily backed up a step at the sight of Michelle's normally pretty face, contorted with hatred. And jealousy? Lily thought it was. But even as she backed away, she felt her temper rising. The picture Michelle painted was the stereotype of a poor woman with too many mouths to feed. Lily had even seen the image on government posters whenever a social services bill was up in Congress. But Michelle had two nannies to help raise her three children. Some of their friends even had three or four nannies. Michelle spent perhaps an hour a day actually being a mother. Michelle had taken out a bottle of pills now, and she swallowed two of them with ease. The digital cleaner had finished, and now the sink was as clean and gleaming as it had been when they came in. Michelle splashed some water on her face and dried it with a towel.
"We should go back out."
When they sat down at the table, Keith leaned over and asked Lily, "Are you all right?" She nodded, fixing a pleasant smile on her face. For the rest of the meal, she tried to keep her eyes off Michelle, but she couldn't help it. Were all of her friends so miserable on the inside? Sarah had answered that question. Jessa, maybe. Her husband Paul was a decent enough guy until he drank. Christine? Lily didn't know. Christine's eyes had a constant glazed shine that could be either drugs or religious fervor. Christine was the head of the women's Bible circle at their church. Lily had never trusted any of her friends, but she had thought she knew them. Over lunch, Lily tried to talk to Keith, who asked after her mother and about her plans for the rest of the summer. But Greg was now staring at Keith as well with the same narrow, suspicious stare. Lily had seen that look many times growing up, on their dog, Henry, who didn't like to share his chew toys with anyone else. Here was the real pig in a poke. She didn't belong to herself any more. She was a doll that Greg had bought and paid for.
"There are ways around that," Maddie whispered.
But it did nothing to alleviate Lily's anxiety. Dr. Davis's clinic was one thing,
But finding a doctor who would perform an abortion, that was a whole different level of illegal.
She suddenly remembered the heavily pregnant woman in the clinic, the one who had bled all over the chair. Was it possible that Dr. Davis performed abortions as well?
Lily had never heard a whisper of that, but of course she wouldn't have. That was something you didn't tell anyone.
Greg was staying at the club to play golf with Mark and a few of their other friends. So Lily went home, alone, glad for the quiet emptiness of the back seat. After Phil dropped her off, she made Dorian some broth and took it to the nursery, along with a bottle of water. She'd been afraid to feed Dorian anything but broth, chicken, and beef. But if Dorian had grown tired of the selection, she didn't say anything. When Lily entered the nursery, she found Dorian on the floor, stretching, reaching for her toes. Her shirt was soaked with sweat. She must be getting better to be able to stretch that way, but she still looked very pale.
"Won't you tear your stitches?" Lily asked.
"Doesn't matter,"
Dorian grunted. She had tied her blonde hair up into messy pigtails, and this made her look more like Maddie than ever.
"Can't afford to be laid up."
"I'm sure he'd rather you get well first."
Out of deference to Dorian, Lily didn't use Tyr's name out loud. But she wondered, was the Englishman really so demanding that he would expect Dorian to be up and about 2 days after being shot? Or did she put this pressure on herself?
"This is a nice nursery," Dorian remarked, "but I don't hear any kids running around."
A wild giggle popped from Lily's mouth.
"I don't want kids."
"Me neither."
"No, I mean, I might want them, but not here." She gestured toward the house around her.
"Not like this.
I take pills."
She had hoped to surprise Dorian, maybe impress her. But Dorian merely nodded and continued with her stretching.
"Have you ever been married?"
"God, no. I'm a dyke."
Lily recoiled, slightly shocked.
"You have sex with women?"
"Sure."
The nonchalance with which Dorian confessed this stunned Lily into silence. Openly confessing a crime to a stranger, especially a serious crime like homosexuality, that seemed like real freedom. She pointed to the scar on Dorian's shoulder.
"Was that from your tag?"
"Yep. First thing we do is to remove that little bastard."
"How?"
"Can't tell you,"
Dorian replied, panting as she reached for her toes.
"Valuable information if you ever are taken into custody."
"I wouldn't tell."
Dorian smiled grimly.
"Everyone tells in the end."
"I mean, I'm trustworthy."
"Trust me with a secret, then. Where do you hide your pills?"
Lily showed Dorian the loose tile in the corner, the pile of contraband underneath.
"It's good. Well camouflaged. How many hiding places do you have?"
"Just this?"
"That's no good. You should always have more than one hiding place."
"I can't hide anything anywhere else. Greg will find it. He does inspections now, but he never comes in here."
"Jonathan says you fix the surveillance in this place."
Dorian gave her a look of frank admiration.
"Where'd a wall lady learn to do something like that?"
"My sister. She was good with computers."
"Well, I'd still get another hiding place. One is never enough."
"How many do you have?"
"When I was a kid, dozens. But I don't have any now."
Dorian pushed herself up and reached for the bowl of broth.
"In the better world, we won't need to hide anything."
"I don't understand. Is the better world biblical? Are angels going to descend and wipe the earth clean?"
"God, no," Dorian replied, laughing. "In the better world, no one will need religion."
"I don't understand," Lily repeated.
"Well, why should you? The better world's not for people like you."
Lily recoiled as though she'd been slapped. Dorian didn't notice. She was busy eating her broth and staring out the glass doors into the backyard. She was waiting, Lily realized now, waiting for the Englishman to come and take her away. Part of her was already gone. Lily left the nursery, closing the door carefully behind her, and went downstairs.
It was all nonsense, she told herself.
Tyr and his people were probably crazy, the whole lot of them.